Good day, and welcome to Detroit Today on 101.9 WDET. I'm Stephen Henderson, and as always, thanks for tuning in. How do we get closer to uncovering truth? This is a question that journalists, of course, ask every day, but it's also a question that's really important to everyone else. Police officers and teachers and concerned citizens are all tasked with trying to understand what's going on around them and to act on truth. Why are prices increasing? Why are bridges collapsing? Why are certain schools funded with less money than others? There have always been a lot of these kinds of questions that demand the public's attention. But the difference today is that there are more data available about all of these things than ever before. And maybe conversely, all of that data make it even more difficult to discern what's true and what's not. How do you know that what you're reading is true, verifiably true? Where did it come from? Who did the work to make sure that it is true? And even more difficult are the people who are trying right now to make it even harder to understand the world. Take Steve Bannon, chief strategist to former President Donald Trump, who made it his explicit goal to, quote, flood the zone with false information. He's not alone. There are a lot of people out there right now who are intentionally trying to mislead by telling lies, by making up data. And what they intend to do is create a chaotic information ecosystem. It makes it harder to pay attention to the news and more challenging to know what is going on in our world. In other words, even as there are more and more and more bits of information available, it's actually getting harder and harder to parse truths from falsehoods, especially in places like the internet. So, how do we trust the information that crosses our path? How do we know that our data is produced with integrity and honesty? British journalist and economist Tim Harford has done a lot of work trying to discern truth and follow knowledge down its seemingly endless rabbit hole. In other words, where does all of this come from, and how do we sort through it to determine what's true and what's not? He does that really well in his latest book, The Data Detective, and Tim Harford joins us now to talk about it. Tim, welcome to Detroit Today.
Thanks very much, Stephen. It's great to be on the show.
Yeah. So this is a book on statistics and rationality, but it starts in a kind of unexpected way. It talks about emotions. So tell me why you begin by warning people to be skeptical of things that pull their emotions in particular directions.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm sure you've noticed, Stephen, but people tend to have feelings about things, and their feelings really influence what they trust and what they don't trust. I begin the book with a story of an art forgery that should never have fooled the experts, but fooled the experts because the experts really wanted to believe that it was a genuine art piece. And the reason that I started a book about statistics with a story about art is to emphasize the centrality of our emotions. We can fool ourselves into believing or disbelieving all sorts of things just because we really want them to be true, or we really want them not to be true. And you can be one of the world's leading experts and you can still make this mistake. And so the book contains 10 rules of thumb, if you like, to think more clearly about the world and think more clearly about statistics. But the first rule of thumb is just to notice how you're feeling. When you hear a headline on the radio, on the TV, you read it in a newspaper, or you see something on social media, the first question you should ask is, how is this making me feel? Am I feeling angry? Do I feel scorn, bitterness, vindication? Oh, this proves I was right. I can go and tell somebody I was right, look at this headline. Any emotion that you're feeling is making you dumber. And of course, we all have emotions. I have emotions. We all have emotions. But just to take a couple of seconds to notice that response and go, oh, interesting. This really seems to have triggered some powerful reaction in me. And then you can go back and have a second look, and you may see things differently after you've become aware of your own emotional reaction.
So those emotions, of course, are not about the data itself. In other words, that's not about whether something is true or not. That's about the culture, I guess, that we're living in, and the time that we're living in, and the charge, I guess, that exists around some of the questions that we are relying on data to explain for us. I feel like that's a difference too right now. In addition to there being more data available than ever before, we're also more invested in the conclusions that we might make from that data because we are so worked up about so many different things.
Yeah. And it feels like this is a difference from past times. I don't know if it really is. It feels different. And maybe it's to do with the fact that we've got a new media environment with specialized TV news channels that are more polarized than before, with social media, talk radio, the shock jocks. It seems that there's a bonus for getting people angry. That's engagement, right? People are engaged. Just doesn't matter how they're engaged. That there's a bonus for triggering this kind of emotional reaction, and so people try to do it. I certainly notice it. I got a couple of 100,000 followers on Twitter, and I tend to tweet stuff that's not very emotional because it's not my scene, and no one ever retweets it. So I'm thinking 200,000 people in principle are following me. No one's retweeting this, and that's just fine. But every now and then, I'll hit a nerve, and then you suddenly see, like, oh, 2,000 people have retweeted this thing. So suddenly people are interested. And it's not because it's the best tweet or the most informative tweet. It's because it's the tweet that emotionally engages people. And I'm not sure that we should be rewarding that behavior, but you know, we do. That's where we are.
Yeah. And so that tension that exists between that emotional instinct and the overwhelming amount of data that's out there, I guess, is the central point of some of what you're talking about here in the book, which is how to downplay one side of that equation, the emotion, and concentrate more on the value and the veracity of the other, the data. Let's first talk about how we even contend with the amount of data that are out there. Sometimes I feel like it's a little like, you know, drinking from a fire hose. I mean, it's a little bit of a cliche, but there is so much out there that I think for a lot of people, it's hard to even begin to understand what's a rational way to process it and then to decide how to make sure that it's true.
Yeah, actually, one suggestion I would have is start with a question rather than starting with the data. I mean, one of the principles of the book is to be more curious and just try to use numbers to try to understand the world rather than to try to win some argument with somebody on Twitter or Facebook. But that means starting with a question. And it's funny, it feels like we're drowning in data. It feels like the graphs and the percentages and so on, they're just flying around. But when you actually start asking specific questions, you very often go, oh, we actually don't have the numbers that we would really want. So just to give you a really specific example, there was a big kind of controversy here in the UK last week, but I think you'll be having the same arguments in the US, I'm sure, about inflation. And is inflation higher for low-income households or not? Mm-hmm. And it might be because low-income households are buying different things to the average household, and they're buying different things to the high-income households. So maybe Maybe those things are going up in price, potatoes, milk, bread. Maybe they're going up in price more than the typical product across the whole economy. If you actually go, okay, well, let's go and find out, what you will discover is the Bureau of Labor Statistics, who assembles the inflation statistics, the data they gather are not built to answer that question. I mean, you can kind of fiddle around and you can do some analysis and you can try, but actually they're not measuring the price of the cheapest rice and the cheapest spaghetti and that sort of thing. They're trying to measure the middle of the market, like the stuff that the typical consumer buys. So in this case, you start with the question, you think you're drowning in data, you realize we don't have the data at all. There are questions that we, as a society, we've kind of decided we're fine with not knowing the answer to this question, which is in itself interesting.
Yeah. So let's talk about the problem that we have with data that are not true. Either not true because of carelessness or an accident versus not true because of intentional efforts to deceive. It seems to me that you've got this kind of twin-sided issue there with you know, the why of what's true and not. But first, just talk about the amount of data that aren't true that are out there and how dangerous that is.
Yeah, and there's another danger, by the way, which is that you don't believe the data that are true. So that's always something to remember. Like, that's one of you mentioned Steve Bannon. One of the reasons he wanted to flood the media ecosystem with false information. He didn't use the phrase false information. He used a four-letter word instead, but we won't.
He did.
The radio. The reason he wanted to flood kind of the media ecosystem with false information is not just, and in fact, I would say not only to get people to believe stuff that wasn't true, it was to get people to disbelieve stuff that was true, because you see so much stuff that isn't true that you start going, well, I don't know, none of it's true. I don't have to believe any of it. And that's really important when you look at, for example, when you look at the conspiracy theorists, when you look at the what happened in the Capitol, the beginning of 2021, the 6th of January. That's not so much about people believing. It's about people disbelieving. It's about who and what people are willing to disbelieve. I'll disbelieve the judiciary. I'll disbelieve the New York Times. I'm going to disbelieve. So disbelief is, indiscriminate disbelief is as damaging as indiscriminate belief. But to come to this sort of, this idea of all the false information, I think the basic principle is to ask yourself, when you see a number, after you've examined your emotional response and you've said, okay, how's this making me feel? Just to ask some really basic questions about it. Like, where does it come from? Is it just some screenshot on social media, or is there an actual link that goes to an actual place? I mean, just saying, oh, this comes from some source doesn't mean anything. Like, is there a link? Can I go and have a look? And then, is this the kind of source that I might actually want to take seriously? Has it got resources behind it? Is it reasonably independent? But also, not just where did this number come from, but does this number say what I think it says? It's astonishing how often people will make statements that are true, but completely misleading. And they're misleading because we think the statement is about one thing, but it's about something else. So the news, the headlines mentioned the shooting at the Oxford High School. Whenever something like that happens, the media reporting will run with how many gun deaths are there in the US every year. And that's not obvious. That's not an obviously relevant number, because we're actually talking about a mass shooting. And the number of gun deaths is not the same as the number of people who get shot in these mass shooting incidents. And in fact, the number of gun deaths is not even the number of people who are murdered with a gun, because many of those deaths are in fact suicide. So I'm not saying we shouldn't talk about gun death. I'm just saying, if you talk about gun deaths in the same context as a school shooting, people mix the two things together, and they're not the same thing. You're measuring two different things, you're counting two different things, and I think if we're going to think clearly about what the policy implications might be, you want to understand what is actually being measured, what's being counted. We very quickly fool ourselves with these things. We think one thing is being measured, and actually it's not.
Yeah. I'm talking with Tim Harford. He's an economist who has a new book that is titled The Data Detective, 10 Easy Rules to Make Sense of Statistics. The conversation we're having is about how we sort through all the data that are out there right now and figure out which are true and which are not. What is the kind of process that we should be going through to try to make sure that we're being told the truth and that we're acting on that truth? We'd love to hear from you during the conversation as well. How do you come to know that things are true or not true? How many sources do you reference before you conclude a particular fact or truth? And are there ways in which you check your own biases, for instance, before you investigate a particular truth? Do you ask yourself whether you're looking for a specific answer or whether you're going into it actually just looking to find out what the answer is? Also, give us a sense of how you're using social media to uncover important information. Is that something that you're relying on, or is that something that you've kind of become tired of because you're finding false information there too often? As always, the number here on the phones is 313-577-1019. That's 313-577-1019. You can also go to the WDET Facebook page or to Twitter and put comments there, and we can work you into the conversation that way. Before we get to our listeners, Tim, I want to talk about the urgency of this question around the pandemic. And I think that the pandemic is a good kind of case study in many of the different things that you're talking about here in the book, many of the different dynamics that have to do with how we discern truth. The question of emotional bias is very strong there because this was a deadly pandemic. Lots of people were losing their lives as we were trying to figure out what was true and what wasn't. There's also, of course, a political bent to some of the production of information about the virus. People who had non-health goals that they wanted to serve by producing certain kinds of information. And then, of course, there are just outright lies that have been told about not just the virus, but also about the restrictions and the reactions. So literally, in this case, getting the data right was a matter of life and death. How well, I guess, as a people, did we do that? How well did that play out, given all of the tensions that you're talking about here in your book?
I think it's an example of some of the best and the worst uses of data. And when coronavirus was first reported, when the news finally came out of China that there was this new respiratory virus, that was the moment when data really started to show how valuable it is. And one of the things I'm trying to get people to think about in the book, in The Data Detective, is that this is not just about spotting liars. It's also about discerning the truth. Truth is important. I'm really glad that in your introduction to this conversation, you talked about the truth, how important the truth is. If you think about this virus, well, what is the truth? What are the truths that we're trying to determine? So number one, how fast is it spreading? Number two, under what conditions does it spread? Number three, how dangerous is it? How many people is it hurting? How many people is it killing? Number four, who's most at risk? Is it to do with age? Is it to do with lifestyle? Is it some genetic condition? Is it something else? And those sorts of questions are absolutely fundamental. And then where is it now? Who is infected now? And can we make judgments about where it's going to spread next? some of those questions we were able to answer really quickly was very impressive. So for example, how dangerous it was, we got that pretty early on. And also who was most at risk. It turns out it's to do with age, very closely connected with age, in a way that's not true for some other pathogens, like flu, you know, kills young people if they're not vaccinated, but COVID very rarely does. All of these questions, we started with a total information vacuum. We know nothing. And there's this amazing work, I would say almost heroic work, being done by epidemiologists, public health officials, virologists, desperately trying to generate answers to these questions. And then we move on to the next questions, which are, well, we've got some possible cures and treatments, vaccines. Are they safe? Do they work? And again, there's a structured process of trying to generate data there. This is amazing. I mean, it's astonishing. We talk about the miracle of the vaccines and how well the vaccines work and how quickly they were developed. And that's all true. But this is also a statistical miracle, a data miracle. Mm-hmm. To be set alongside that, you have right from the start, outright nonsense, conspiracy theories, but also a lot of very manipulative presentation of data that leads people to draw the wrong conclusions. And I think is deliberately designed to invite people to draw the wrong conclusions or systematically misrepresenting what scientists are saying. So just to give you an example, there were data that came out of the UK. The UK's got some very good data in on the pandemic, but it did the rounds in the US. I think Joe Rogan picked it up on his podcast. And this data seemed to suggest that people were actually more at risk if they were vaccinated than unvaccinated. Mm-hmm. And that just seemed bizarre. Like, how can that be? How can the vaccine actually be doing harm? When you looked at the data, and this was just the public health authorities have been a bit careless in the way they presented it. At the time, all the people who were vaccinated were really old because we vaccinated the elderly first. And all the people who were unvaccinated were young. And we know that risk is massively correlated with being older. So you look at this without adjusting for age, you just go, oh, it seems that the vaccinated population is still going to hospital and the unvaccinated population is fine. But the unvaccinated population, their average age was, 21. And the age of the vaccinated population on average was, I think, about 50. Of course, they're going to have different outcomes. So you see these really confused, mistaken, sometimes deliberately manipulated presentations of data mm-hmm. alongside heroic work, brilliant work. So that's why I say it's the best and the worst.
Yeah. When we come back, we're going to continue this conversation with Tim Harford about data and truth. And we're going to get going on the phones. Call and tell us what your prize is for discerning what's true and what's not right now, as there are more data available about almost everything than ever before. And when we have some really urgent questions to answer that we need data in order to come up with the truth. What's your process for determining truth, for instance, about the pandemic? Where are you getting information about COVID-19 and the restrictions and the vaccines that you trust? What are some places that you don't trust, where you've found misinformation? What's the role of the media in all of this? Do you trust media to tell you the truth, not just about the pandemic, but about all of the things that we worry about and talk about? 313-577-1019 is the number on the phones. That's 313-577-1019. We'll get to Brian in Dearborn next. You should join him by calling in. Also, go to Facebook and to Twitter and put comments there, and we can include you in the show that way. We'll be right back with more Detroit Today. You're listening to Detroit Today on 101.9 WDET. I'm Stephen Henderson, and as always, I'm glad you've joined us. My guest this hour is economist Tim Harford. He has a new book called The Data Detective, 10 Easy Rules to Make Sense of Statistics. We're talking about how we all try to make sense of statistics, the data that are out there. So much information is available these days in so many different ways on so many different mediums. How do we sort through it all to find truth? How do we sort through it all to know that the things that we're acting on are true? Give us a call and join the conversation. 313-577-1019. That's 313-577-1019. You can also go to Facebook or Twitter, put comments there, and tell us what your process looks like for sorting through all of these things. I want to read a couple of social media comments. Aaron on Twitter says, taking into consideration the source is crucial for me. Also, just basic questioning. You don't have to be Woodward or Bernstein to find out if something doesn't pass the smell test. And a lot of misinformation is designed to falter when examined closer. Tim, I want to start there with you. This question of questioning, you talked a little about that, but that's kind of at the heart of some of your rules here for determining what's true and what's not.
That's absolutely right. And the questions are not that complicated. You're right, you don't need to be Woodward or Bernstein, and you don't need to be Einstein either. You don't need to be, a genius mathematician, statistician, to ask straightforward questions. So we already talked about the question of, well, how do I feel? Am I having an emotional reaction? Am I on the way to fooling myself? And this other question of, well, what is this actually counting? What in fact are we measuring here? What's the definition involved? The number seems impressive, but what is the number actually referring to? So another question that people can ask is it a big number or a small number? Like, is it going up or down? These are simple questions about context, but very often, numbers are stripped of context. So you see a tweet, it's a soundbite in a presidential debate or a candidate speech or a headline, and you don't necessarily have the context to understand whether the number should worry you or not. I mean, a lot of data series, they bounce up and down, and if you pick two particular points, you can say, oh, it's up 15% over the last 2 years, or it's down 20% over the last 6 years. And the answer is, well, it goes up and down, and maybe there's nothing really here to worry about. So asking, is it going up or down? Asking what it means, asking whether it's a big number. These are things that, should be fairly straightforward. I advocate in the book the idea of having landmark numbers. So a landmark number is something you can just carry in your head that helps you make useful comparisons. So, for example, the population of the U.S. is about 330 million people. So if somebody says, oh, I'm going to spend $1 billion, you go, okay, that's $3 a person. Mm-hmm. The maths aren't that complicated. You could do it on a calculator or your phone, or you could often do it in your head. And you can tell, okay, $3 a person for every person in the U.S., okay, that's, I know how much that is. That's, it's a Starbucks coffee for everyone. That's $1 billion. Having those sorts of comparisons in your head really help make sense of the data. I mean, there's one claim that occasionally goes around is that 4 million women are killed every year by their partners in the US. And clearly the intimate partner violence is a huge problem. And because people feel it's a huge problem, they share that number. But then when you think about it, you go, well, you're telling me that, like, so 1% of all the people in the US, so 2% of all the women in the US are murdered every year by their partners. That can't possibly be true. There wouldn't be anybody left. That must be false. But you have to do that little bit of work and go, does that number add up? Does that 4 million match my knowledge of what the American population actually is? Can it possibly make sense or not? And as I say, you don't need to be Einstein. Just need to take a moment, some simple sums, and you can figure out whether a number is worth taking seriously or it isn't.
Yeah. Again, 313-577-1019 is the number here on the phones. Let's go to Melissa in Metro Detroit. Melissa, welcome to the show.
Hi, Stephen. Excuse me. Hello to your guest. Right. So when I hear data or a conclusion that they're proffering to me, I try to wonder, are they trying to inform me with the truth or are they trying to influence me with their ego or the group they represent's ego, which is, you know, their unawareness of the truth.
So, Melissa, that's a great question. And Tim, I wonder if you can talk just a little about, I mean, we were talking about the emotional bias that we might bring to a situation where we're trying to get information about something. What Melissa's talking about is the suspicion we might have about the person producing the information. And whether that should lead us to skepticism. I think that's harder to know in a lot of cases because, again, there's so much information out there and it's hard for any of us to know exactly who is generating much of it. But it also seems like what Melissa's talking about is pretty important, that if you can identify who it is and assign some bias to them, then that should inform your process too.
I think so. I mean, there's the motives of people are important. And very often our motives are not to seek the truth. I mean, this is true even as individuals. We like to think we're all seeking the truth, but often, you know, we're seeking social approval. We want to fit in with our friends. We want to be seen to say the right things. We wouldn't be human if we cared only about the truth and nothing else. And that's true for the people who are trying to influence us as well. So I mean, a rule of thumb, I would say, is that, you know, I would listen to a politician trying to state what they believe in and what their priorities are. But the moment they're trying to deliver a statistical justification of their record or a statistical attack on an opponent's record, at that point you go, I could probably get a better, more independent, more balanced view of whether, you know, this policy record is working or not. I mean, I'm not somebody who I know is biased. Even if I'm on their side, I know they're biased. So I want to seek out some sort of independent source of information. And the great thing is that there is a lot of independent information around. There, you know, the scientists, there are independent think tanks, try to be quite balanced, quite centrist. So you can always look for that. Nobody is ever completely neutral. Nobody is ever completely independent, and nobody is ever pursuing the truth and nothing else. But it's not that hard to figure out where someone is coming from and get a sense of it. And if you pause for a couple of seconds and have a think about it, very often you can see what's going on. Mm-hmm. And that's something worth doing.
So listening to you answer Melissa's question also makes me think about the value of comparison and the comparative process. In other words, if you're trying to find the truth about something, it makes sense to go to more than one source and compare the sources of that information, but also compare the information itself, and that's an important kind of deductive skill to have when you're trying to find the truth as well. Being able to say, I've seen this now in many different places, and that suggests perhaps more veracity than if I'd only seen it in one place. I've seen it come from these people, and I know that you know, I know who they are, so I'm going to believe it.
Absolutely, and of course, people will have their own views about the kinds of sources they believe. So, you know, there are certain conspiracy theorists who would say, well, the very fact that a respected media source is saying this is reason to distrust it. Oh, right. The CDC is saying it. Oh, the FBI is saying it. Well, of course, it must be a lie. And, you know, there you go. At least in that case, you have somebody with a consistent view of the media ecosystem. I don't share that view, but at least there is some logic to it. There's a view as to, you know, the kinds of sources you trust. And we can all, I think, make our decisions about the kinds of sources we want to trust. The interesting thing is, some of the research that psychologists have been doing on this is that very often we can detect the truth. We just don't bother to try because everything's happening so fast and the truth is not a priority. We just decide to retweet something or share something on social media. We see something on the TV and we immediately turn to a friend or a spouse. And we haven't thought for a moment as to whether it's true. And there are some experiments where you show people with quite strong partisan views, you know, quite strong right or left-leaning views. You show them certain fake headlines and true headlines. And you ask, well, would you share this? Would you share that one? Oh, there are these terrorists with suicide vests showing up at the Mexican border, says this guy on Facebook, would you share that? You ask people whether they'd share the stuff. And generally what people would do is they share the stuff they tend to sympathize with. But if instead you first ask, here's a headline, do you think it's true? So you get them to stop for a moment and just think about whether a headline is true. And then you show them a whole bunch of stories, true and false, and ask them whether they'd share it. At that point, having been just kind of nudged to think about the truth, people are much more discriminating. And they'll say, oh, well, I kind of have some sympathy with this story about this terrorist with suicide vest showing up at the Mexican border, but actually now you've got me to think about whether it's true. It doesn't sound like it is true. Actually, that doesn't sound like the way that terrorists would operate, and I actually don't believe it, and I won't share it. So you can nudge people to think a little bit about the truth, and we can do it. This is one of the messages of the book. We can do it. We have to want to try. We have to be willing to slow down, notice our emotions, and actually try. And if we try, very often we can succeed. Mm.
Let's go to the phones again here. Brian in Dearborn. What's on your mind, Brian?
Hi, Steve. I've worked in both public relations and journalism. And I'm a really big advocate for anybody considering either career to study statistical reasoning, to take a few classes while they're in college in applied statistics, because so much of the discussion these days is not a competition of ideas, but a competition of facts, of statistical facts and statistical numbers. And I think one of the reasons why there has been a bit less enthusiasm for journalists and popular media these days is because we're not always able to give them the information that they really need to mm-hmm. understand the difference between two competing arguments based off statistics. And so more and more, I think we're thrust in this role of really having to be arbiters of not just logical reasoning, but mathematical reasoning. Huh. And I want to give you a really simple example. Back in 2015, I was writing for the Huffington Post, and there was a police shooting in my hometown of Dearborn. And activists began using statistics from 2012 about the number of African Americans that had been pulled over or arrested by Dearborn police. Mm-hmm. And I noticed that the number was this huge number. I mean, it was definitely an outlier compared to the other ones. And recognizing that it was an outlier, I investigated. And I found out that was actually a year where Dearborn police had gotten into an agreement with the city of Detroit to actually help police large sections of Detroit along the border. So it was almost as if Dearborn police had added, 60,000 African-American citizens to the city. But the statistics that were being cited were comparing it just to the actual residents of Dearborn. So this is an opportunity where providing context, recognizing an outlier, helped kind of moderate that discussion so that, we're not picking sides, but we're making sure that the reader has everything they need to know to understand the difference. Because I think when we just are filled with competing statistics and there's no referee in the media, it leads to the despair of, well, they're all lying, or, well, they're all right. They all have statistics and it's all, nonsense. And that's really our job, to come in and provide that extra information and to recognize those trends.
Yeah, Brian, I love that you called and shared that. And Tim, we haven't talked too much about the media's role, but that's a great example of the necessity to, as you say, to question and then find out the truth, and in Brian's case, disseminate it so that people can believe.
Yeah, it's a great example, and it's an example of where you need to ask a couple of questions. You look at something, you say, "Oh, the number seems odd. What's going on? Is the number wrong?" No, the number's not wrong, but the number isn't showing you what you think it shows you. It's showing you a different situation than the situation you assumed you were looking at. And that requires a certain amount of statistical confidence. And I think but it's not, again, it's not like a super complex thing. It's not like you have to get deep into chi-squared tests and statistical significance and Bayesian reasoning and all this complex stuff. What Brian was doing was just going, number seems strange. I should make a couple of calls, check some websites, figure out what's going on. And that confidence is really important. And journalists need it. And I think citizens need it as well. Because too often we just say to ourselves, "Oh, I'm not going to believe any of these statistics. They're all it's all fake news. I don't believe any of it. They're just trying to fool me." And the most popular book ever published about statistics was called How to Lie with Statistics. And it's all about misinformation. But we would never accept the argument that you can't ever believe words, because people sometimes lie with words. And you're like, you should just avoid words. Don't listen to any words. We would say that was absurd. Of course, you need to listen to words and listen to what people are saying, and you need to make a judgment. Using everything, all of your experience, you need to make a judgment as to whether these things are true or false. But when it comes to statistics, we often feel incapable of making that judgment. Mm-hmm. So I fully endorse Brian's idea of journalists taking some basic statistics classes. I would endorse the idea of citizens reading The Data Detective or other good books about numbers. Because as I say, it's important, but it's not as technical as people often think to ask the right questions.
Yeah. When we come back, we're going to continue this conversation about truth and data and how we sort through data to find truth. I want to continue to hear from you as well. 313-577-1019 is the number on the phones. We'll hear from Ray in Auburn Hills next. We also have a number of social media comments still to get to. You can go to Facebook or Twitter, put your comments there, and we'll try to include them in the conversation as well. We'll be right back with more Detroit Today.
WDET is your place for open dialogue.
The music you love.
Real news and in-depth analysis.
And cultural experiences. The sound of Detroit.
101.9 WDET is your public radio station.
You're listening to Detroit Today on 101.9 WDET. I'm Stephen Henderson, and as always, thanks for joining us. My guest is Tim Harford, an economist, award-winning columnist and broadcaster, who is the author of a new book, The Data Detective, 10 Easy Rules to Make Sense of Statistics. We're talking about truth-seeking through all the information that's out there right now, and figuring out what to believe and what not, what to act on and what not. Give us a call, 313-577-1019, to join the conversation, or go to social media and put comments there. Zach on Twitter says, "Information, depth, and details are key for me. I prefer a Fauci interview on The Journal or on WDET over a cable news chyron. The information is sometimes lost in translation with the latter." Glenn on Twitter says, "For me, some of it comes down to background. I studied history and worked in healthcare with a lot of data. The portion of the population who are trained to do research is such a small subset, and that shows in our discourse. Misinformation is free. Good info is expensive." I want to go back to the phones here and to Ray in Auburn Hills. Ray, what's on your mind?
Yes, sir. Thanks for taking my call. That's a good conversation today. As an IT guy, I have a tendency to not believe a lot of what's sent to me. obviously spam, things like that. But with the news, I think we need to be especially critical in examining that. I tend to be a non-believer in a lot of things until I can validate it. So I tend to listen more to news sources like NPR, like PBS, and take a look at information on the wire services like AP, Reuters, et cetera, because they focus more on the facts. I don't think that some of the cable news networks did any services by providing, by going away from a lost leader type of philosophy with the news, so that your news and opinion tend to be blended, and it's hard to differentiate sometimes, and people treat opinion as news. So, but I tend to just look at, when I get a fact, I try to find other sources, try to look at, like has been suggested, try to dive into it a little bit more so that I can make up my own mind based on what you said. It's just, how does it feel to me? Does it seem incredulous, or does it seem within the realm of possibility? So,
yeah. Ray, I'm glad you called and shared that that insight and that approach. Tim, I do want to talk a little more about cable news and social media, which I think are two sources of information that have really changed the body of information that's out there. Cable news has changed itself dramatically over the last 10 or 15 years, and maybe because of the influence of social media, which has really grown to be such a big part of our information flow in the last 10 years, they both get criticized a lot for not misinformation. I think it's non-contextual information. I think it's more the complaint that that it's hard to discern what's true because they're really not telling you a whole lot to begin with, and you're not given the context to try to figure out whether it's true.
Yeah, I think that you're absolutely right to point to context. Actually, before I wanted to reply to Ray, because I love the analogy of the spam filter, because if you've ever looked in your spam folder, you find all kinds of junk in there, but every now and then you find an important message as well. And one of the tricks is, you don't want to turn the spam filter up too much and send real emails to spam. You don't want to have it turned down too much and just get all the spam in your inbox. And that we really face the same problem with consuming news. You don't want to disbelieve everything. That's as bad as believing everything. So yeah, I just love that idea from Ray. On context, you're absolutely right. Social media, people worry about, you know, social media being a bubble, but actually on social media, you're often exposed to opposing views. That's why people find social media kind of stressful, because there's people arguing with them all the time. But what that argument often lacks is context. And I think cable TV often lacks context. One of the ways to get context is to consume slower sources of news, as well as your morning news. Obviously, your morning radio is important, but maybe read a weekly magazine, or here's a radical idea, a book from time to time. They're going to give you much more context. They're going to give you a very different perspective. And once you have the context, you can actually start thinking critically about the things to disbelieve and the things to believe.
Okay, Tim Harford, it was really great to have you here with us to talk about information and truth and how to find it. And congratulations on the book, which is a wonderful read. Thanks so much for being here with us.
It's really kind of you to invite me on the show. Thanks for the great conversation. Yeah, see you next time.
Yes, yes. Okay, that is going to do it for us today. Come back tomorrow when Windsor Mayor Drew Dilkins is going to join to talk about this Canadian trucker protest that is blocking traffic on the Detroit-Windsor border. Really interesting set of occurrences there and reactions that I think are going to reverberate for quite some time here in our community. Detroit Today is produced by Jake Neer and Sam Corey. The program director is Joan Isabella. The technical director and engineer is Matthew Trevethan. And Detroit Today's music is created by Sam Bobian and Will Sessions. This is 101.9 WDET FM, Detroit's NPR station, your connection to news, music, and conversation. We'll talk again tomorrow.